It was quite simply a horrific result.
Boris Johnson has promised to repay the trust of voters after leading the Conservatives to an extraordinary election victory.
It was a huge mandate for the British Tories and a personal victory for Boris Johnson.
Johnson says the election results are, quote, irrefutable mandate in support of Brexit.
And so it was a crushing defeat, not only for all those who hoped and dreamed of a transformed Britain, but also for the cause of remaining inside the European Union. Now, as sure as night follows day, Britain is leaving the EU. Welcome to the Another Europe podcast with me, Luke Cooper, and my co-host Zoe Williams. Today we take stock of the anger and the agony of last week. We ask where now for the left, where now for another Europe is possible, and what it all means for what, in all likelihood, will be 4 or 5 years of Tory rule. To take stock, we met up with Michael Chesham from the Another Europe office in a cafe in South London. Few people have fought so hard for the cause these last few years. To feedback to us or to send us ideas for new podcast content, do get in touch with us on podcast@anothereurope.org. And if you enjoy the discussion, please give us a rating or review on your podcast platform. Over the last 2 years, we have had thousands upon thousands of listeners, but still not so many ratings or reviews. So if you've meant to leave us one, but never quite got round to it, why don't you cheer us all up in the Another Europe team and leave us one today? Either way, hope you enjoy the discussion. And never give up, because a better world for all of us is very much still possible.
Do you feel like you were expecting it to be this bad?
You did expect this to be as bad as it was, because we were all rather optimistic in the last week or so of the campaign, because we thought, the campaign is so big, so vibrant, it's got to have some effect on the polls, and there must be a systematic error in the polling somehow, that this isn't registering. And you're like, nope, we're heading for defeat.
My feeling about 2 weeks out was that we were waiting for a bounce that was never going to happen. Why did I think that? Well, I thought that because the moments of the campaign hadn't worked out. We didn't have the social care fiasco. The Tories weren't running a terrible campaign. And ultimately, all of the moments, all of the things where you thought, oh, we're really nailing on this, we're actually all in a bubble. So the Andrew Neil interview stuff, you know, that video of Andrew Neil challenging Boris Johnson to come on be interviewed. Oh, that's had millions of views. Oh, you know, oh, Stanley Johnson's gone on and, you know, it called ordinary people stupid. Oh, well, I've got millions of views. Well, actually, it was all in a bubble. So all of the stuff that we needed to happen and needs to be really widely understood and widely played out happened kind of like on Twitter and in a media sphere, and didn't really cut through all of the scandals, all of the, you know, the screw-ups of the Tory campaign in 2017. I also felt that there was just a ceiling on how well we could do because of how unpopular Corbyn was and because of the fact that we just weren't doing that well in the debates. And I think that essentially our entire campaign failed to cut through because it was communicated terribly. We had, I don't like repeating, we're streeting, but we had a manifesto that was less than the sum of its parts. A huge, radical, brilliant manifesto in many ways that was just sort of communicated in really the worst possible way it could have been, you know. I didn't know what was in the manifesto. On the doorstep, I would basically just talk about the NHS because that was what won people over, or about Brexit if you were talking to a Lib Dem. But really, I couldn't have told you what was in the manifesto. So, I mean, God knows what the average member of the public thought was in the manifesto.
Because in a way, there's three explanations for the defeat, isn't there? One, Brexit. Two, Corbyn. Three, the manifesto.
Within each of those points, there's a kind of branching effect within each, right? So if you say the problem was Corbyn, I never thought the problem was, you know, the magic granddad stuff, but he kind of just looks like a crazy old dude with wonky glasses. But there was a real, I think there was a real problem with the culture of the Corbyn circle. And you know, I have been a Corbyn Easter, but I wouldn't have called myself a Corbyn Easter at any point in the past 2 years, I don't think. Because they were really poisonous. And we saw that as Remain campaigners, that every time you kind of gathered any evidence, they wouldn't listen to it. Every time you gathered any head of steam, Unite tried to hose it down. You hose steam, but let's just leave that. You know, there was a culture of bullying and unresponsiveness and control, basically. There was a culture of, we've read the rule book, and if you say anything we don't like, we're just going to snuff it out. And that demoralised me really intensely, but I thought, well, this is because I'm a Romaniac, not the trademark Romaniac, I just want to remain. And I'm quite close to the action, so yeah. I can see these machinations, and your average voter can't see these machinations.
Yeah.
But I think everybody could see them. I think you didn't have to be very close to the action.
Yeah, I mean, party management and a culture of control wrecked the Corbyn project more than anything else, and I think that shift happened probably at some point in 2017.
Do you think it actually happened as a result of not doing as badly as I thought they were going to in 2017?
The problem with trying to analyse the criminology of the Corbyn project and when it turned, you know, and when the problems became more ingrained, I think once Unite became more in control, is that it's a bit like trying to analyse Jeremy Corbyn's Brexit position. It's not just that I don't know what it is, it's that I don't really know how I would know what it is, how it's been formulated, why it is as it is. So it's that the very problem is that I don't know what happened inside that machine in an exact way. I'm a relatively plugged in activist. There are a handful of people who do. The only time, as activists, as another year as possible, with people who are, you know, pretty much all on side with the Corbyn project, many of us have worked alongside it for a long time, many of us have been a direct part of it. The only time we were ever spoken to was when we were a problem.
Yes.
Now, the only time we have ever managed to get a meeting with Corbyn's office was in the run-up to the 2019 conference, when we started being a problem for them. And basically they were there to tell us to demobilise and stop doing this. You're a problem, stop doing what you're doing. And that was basically it. And you were suddenly treated like a real player, but you were only treated as a player basically when you had a big stick.
But that's the only language they understand, right? All they understand is your power to destroy. Yeah. They don't understand your power to actually help or create anything.
A lot of people will and have said, you know, why weren't Remainers able to go with Labour's soft Brexit compromise from the start? And like, I find this argument infuriating, because Another Europe Is Possible and many others campaigned for a soft Brexit. We campaigned for a free movement, effectively single market, we didn't say single market, we said, you know, effectively a free movement hyper soft Brexit in the immediate aftermath of the vote. Labour didn't offer that, and if the Labour leadership was ever going to come to some kind of understanding with Remainers, where Remainers and the Corbyn leadership could step together into the future, and where we could back them, and they wouldn't have to, you know, do anything supposedly silly, though I don't think it was silly, like a second referendum, then they would have had to have opened up a channel and listened to us. You know, why wasn't a soft Brexit compromise possible? Well, partly it's because the Lexiters, several of whom are at the core of the project, didn't want it. But it's also because they just weren't willing to talk to all of the people, to all of the Remainers, both on the left of the party and outside of the left of the party, who would, very early on, have been willing to compromise with them, and who were actually campaigning for a soft Brexit anyway. And so actually, when we talk about, you know, are Remainers to blame, or did the second referendum cost us this election? Well, actually, how we ended up there with a polarised country and a polarised membership, I think the leadership actually have to take quite a lot of the flak for that, because they fundamentally failed to reach out to anyone on the Remain side, including those of us who were literally campaigning for the position that they later took. And I do think it's important that we are careful about they and who they are, because we're not talking here about the Labour left in total.
No.
What we're actually talking about is, look, a specific political tradition around the Morning Star, the Communist Party, and Unite, the trade union. It's kind of mesh together with a certain politics that existed around the old Labour left, but also, frankly, I think when you talk about the McCluskey, you're really talking about the old Labour right.
Yeah.
Actually, you're talking about a kind of a socially conservative or a willing to pander to social conservatism politics that goes alongside a culture of control and all the rest of it. And also just like a nasty macho culture. There was a nasty bullying macho culture at the core of that project. But that's not all that project was. It wasn't all that project was, just either at the core, certainly not around, not Jeremy himself. I mean, Jeremy's not a macho man.
Yeah.
And in fact, one of the great ironies of how things played out in the end is that, you know, so much of why Jeremy became unpopular with the population is this ingrained toxic masculinity in wider discourse. But nonetheless, the new establishment of the party did contain that kind of quite nasty culture. And you're seeing that play out now. I mean, you'll see it play out in Young Labour, you'll see it play out in CLPs all over the country. And that, unfortunately, there's probably a layer of people who came into politics for the first time who've been taught all of the wrong lessons about how to do politics. You get, you know, you do politics by being as loyal as you can to the tendency that's currently in power. You shut down dissent. You basically find whatever reason it is that you have to in order to support the leadership position.
Just to jump back a little bit to the general election itself, you know, to what extent was this a failure of unity with other political parties? Because basically you had an informal pact with the Brexit Party and the Tories standing down in all of those Conservative held seats. And there, according to Data Praxis, their report that came out after the general election, there were 28 different constituencies where the combined vote for Liberals and Greens was sufficient to give Labour a majority in those seats that Labour lost. So, you know, can you anticipate after this and in this Labour leadership election, there'll be another debate about proportional representation, Progressive Alliance type issues within the Labour Party?
Well, the thing is, because I did a lot of work on the Progressive Alliance in 2017, Labour were complete dicks about that. You know, there were a lot of Lib Dem activists, Green activists, working full tilt for a Labour victory, and Labour wouldn't even... They were gloating. I mean, seriously, and back then I was still in the kind of... back to the kind of media back channel before I got ejected for reasons that were obviously to do with Remaininess, but that's another problem which we can talk about another day. I would listen to all these conversations between the Labour press people and the journalists around them where they'd go, do you know what, it's just really funny that the Lib Dems keep talking about Progressive Alliance because it just means we get to wipe out the Greens. And you're like, this is just poisonous. This is completely poisonous. And they did get a bounce from it in 2017, but I think they, in their response to that, their gracelessness, they sowed the seeds for it not being able to happen again. So I wasn't at all surprised that we didn't make any electoral pact, even though it's never been more important. I didn't actually think a kind of Stop Boris pact was a goer, just because Labour's so difficult in that context.
Looking forward, I mean, with Labour losing more Remain votes in this election than Leave votes, you know, there was clearly a rupture in the Progressive vote, even though the Liberal Democrats didn't have a good campaign and had a pretty derisory election, they still did well enough.
But I think what this election says to me is that once people swing behind something, they swing behind it. They just do. So I don't think we're never, ever going to have an election where it's just one more team, a couple more Lib Dems, and then Labour will have a victory. It's like if Labour wins, it will be because people swing behind Labour. So I'm completely in favour of ripping up the first past the post and having proportional representation and having a kind of fair number of MPs per vote, per number of votes. But I don't think it actually makes that much difference to the way people vote and what they feel is possible.
I was very involved in tactical.vote, like the website, and we did have a lot of hits in the general election. I think we had 2 million unique visitors using the site, not enough. And I think, you know, you always encounter the problem with tactical voting that in the end, are there going to be enough voters that are going to vote tactically in order to make the difference? Here we were kind of overwhelmed by the scale of the Tory wave, the tactical voting to make a difference. But if there was an electoral pact, you kind of force the question amongst those voters. And I feel we definitely shouldn't call it Progressive Alliance, but next time around, maybe anti-Boris Alliance, presumably, is going to stand again.
But, you know, in this instance, there are 28 seats, and there are kind of London seats where it's disappointing that we didn't manage to get it away. But there is a real problem with all the seats that went Tory in the North and the Midlands, and they wouldn't have made much difference with tactical voting or a Progressive Alliance.
It would have made some difference. I think Progressive Alliance and PR, and they are separate things, and I think PR is a lot less contentious than Progressive Alliance, will undoubtedly play a role in the leadership elections that are to come and in Labour's next moves. I think the problem with the way that sort of progressives and very often people who are sort of on our bit of the left engage with the issue of Progressive Alliance or Red-Green Bloc or anti-Boris coalition or whatever it is that we sort of engage with it in a very superficial way. We say, well, look, we've got all these parties who are against the Tories. They need to get together to beat the Tories, because if you add their vote shares up, then they beat them. And they beat them in these constituencies because it split the vote like this and whatever. Intellectually, that may be true, but politically, obviously, it's a lot more complicated than that. And the reason why Progressive Alliance and electoral pacts are such a problem in the debate and why they're not obvious is because this goes to the core of what Labour is. Everything to do with Labour's entire history is challenged by this concept. That's why there's such a reaction against it from some quarters. Labour was set up to represent working class people, as opposed to the Liberal Party, which didn't. And there was a huge debate within the Labour movement at the time. It was, you know, look, what, you know, we just need to take over the Liberal Party, you know, and lots of trade union leaders became Liberal MPs. Both here and in other countries, socialists went into various bits of the existing, what we would call sort of, you know, centre-left party, the Liberals or whatever they were. And the question at the time must have been posed, well, look, are you going to run in this election and split the anti-Tory vote, knowing that that will mean that people die as a result, that working class people's lives will get worse as a result of this? And our answer to that was, yes, we will split the vote. Yes, we will run, because we're going to build a project that represents working class people. And so it's a tricky question for Labour when all of this comes out. Now, I personally am in favour of an electoral pact in order to get PR so that we can then run against each other once again. But it kind of goes to the core of Labourism, of this idea that Labour is the representative of working class people. And if you're ever going to convince Labour of the need for an electoral pact, you're going to have to convince Labour activists and the Labour rank and file that doing an electoral pact doesn't mean abandoning the Labour project.
I just think in practice the fortunes of the Liberal Democrats, and it's true, and Labour rise and fall together, and you've seen that in this election. So while a lot of the focus for this discussion that we just had is on Labour's attitude to alliances, of course there was no conceivable way that Jo Swinson would have gone into alliance with Corbyn in this election.
Yeah.
And in some ways you could see the whole thing as like a playing out of this tragic comic like split between left Romania and middle class Liberal Britain that has handed Johnson victory. So what is salvageable after the defeat?
It's interesting, isn't it? I don't think anything's salvageable.
We're leaving the European Union. There will be a debate in the Labour leadership about what line it now takes on Brexit. And that would be interesting. I mean, the sensible position, which I'd imagine most candidates would take, if you look at someone like Lisa Nandy, she's very clear, from what I understand, that Labour should oppose Boris Johnson's Brexit and support single market membership as an alternative, even though she's seen as one of the Brexity Leavey MPs. She's saying, well, we're always against that. Very clear that should oppose an American trade deal that threatens our NHS and all of that kind of stuff. It will be interesting to see whether Rebecca Long Bailey tries to put forward some kind of fudge that no one understands and can't be and doesn't have any substance and can't be articulated clearly, and then say this is the position of the left or this is the position of the Corbyn left. I think if she does that, she'll be making a very, very serious mistake in this leadership.
But look, I mean, I agree with you. I'm really in favour of Labour voting against pretty much anything Boris brings forward. Oppose that. I mean, you know, set your strategy. We're going to oppose. Accept that you will lose in your opposition. It's like that Henri Bergson line about Protestants beating Catholics. They did not beat them by protesting against Catholicism. They beat them by creating their own internal energy, which was so infectious and so attractive that people joined them. And that's what we've got to concentrate on.
The process of building a serious political movement that's capable of challenging the Tories invariably is going to involve street mobilisations, it's going to involve protesting, it's going to involve running football clubs and food banks, if that's a way it can go. It's going to involve all kinds of things, and the renewal of the Labour Party has to come through its relationship to social movements. So, look, Brexit's going to happen, but there is no point between now and the 31st of January attempting to say that, you know, we might stop Brexit. As another Europe is possible, we've said, you know, in principle we're in favour of readmission to the EU. In principle, that's easier before the end of the transition period, at the end of 2020. If a miracle happens, then I would imagine we would support that. But fundamentally, we are dealing with what the government after Boris Johnson will do, and we're dealing with resisting all of the worst bits of that. So fundamentally, this is a struggle about migrants' rights, trade deals, environmentalism, and potentially new things. It would not surprise me if Boris Johnson really comes after our human rights. A lot of the Tories are quite open about their agenda to actually ultimately scrap a lot of human rights legislation, which they haven't gone near yet, but with a big majority they may well be tempted to do so.
That concludes the podcast for those listening on the podcast platforms. Members of Another Europe is Possible get access to additional material as a benefit of supporting the campaign. As you've heard, we're not going anywhere, and we've got lots to do. After the referendum in 2016, we said it was better to light a candle than curse the darkness. It was true then, and it's very much true now. So please do join us and support the campaign. Go to anothereurope.org/join. In this week's Extra Time, we turn the tables on a rather England-centric discussion and think about what the result means for Ireland and Scotland. Is the end of the Union in sight, or is this just the start of another almighty row?
We've had a very English and Wales-centric discussion, but obviously this is a huge vote in Scotland, where the SNP won by a landslide. And also in Northern Ireland, it's quite an interesting vote, where the DUP lost two seats. So both remain voting nations of the United Kingdom. Question of a border poll in Northern Ireland now being promoted by people like Sinn Féin, but Alliance Party got 16% of the vote, so cross community party that we met when we were out there, and now the Scottish government is going to have a big conflict with Westminster over a second poll. So it seems that conflict between the nations of England, Wales, Scotland and Northern Ireland is going to be a big part of the next 5 years.
I mean, my first thought is that SNP cannot call a second referendum without the Tories agreeing to it, and they're not going to. So I kind of feel the same about them as I feel about us protesting decisions that we have no say over. But to go back a second, that result for Nicola Sturgeon is phenomenal, especially considering the Alex Salmond scandal broke just before it. And what they did is that they took this, the kind of the building of a social movement that you were talking about, Michael, that they built for a yes vote, which they didn't win. They then migrated to make them the kind of strongest progressive party in the country, to the obliteration of the Labour Party, which had always banked those votes, right? So imagine if we'd done that. Imagine if the Labour Party had done that with our lost referendum, if they'd taken the kind of grassroots picture of a relationship with Europe and the world built for the referendum and then used it as a kind of powerful motivating force to vote Labour, I think we would be in the same, we would be like the English SNP, except without the ethno-nationalism.
Ethno-nationalist is a bit harsh. Civic nationalist.
Country, or maybe, if you know Edinburgh quite well, according to my accent, I am actually Scottish.
The death of dialect.
Did you grow up in Scotland?
I was born in Sheffield and my family moved to Scotland when I was 4 years old. So I grew up in Edinburgh, went to the same state school, local comprehensive. I'm an Anglo-Scot.
Why do you sound so un-Scottish?
Because, the death of dialect is phenomenal.
It's also because I know people who grew up in Edinburgh and sound like I do, who were born there as well, and whose parents were born there. Edinburgh is quite a... people call it an English city, it's not, but there's lots of Anglo-Scots in it, especially in the bit that I live in. So I think Scotland faces a really interesting, overarching series of factors. There's all this stuff about, you know, will the SNP get a majority in the next series of Holyrood elections? Will the Tories allow them to have a referendum? My guess is not, but I think that might be a little bit more flexible than we think it is, depending on how things go. And there's various factors in that, but I think broadly speaking, there are two big overarching factors to do with the geopolitics, if you like, of this situation that make it one of which makes it much harder, and one of which makes it much easier for the SNP and the independence movement. One is that, you know, the anti-independence movement always used to be a movement against more borders. You know, there was a left-wing case against independence that said we're in favour of not erecting more borders. We don't want one with England. Less borders, not more. Well, actually, if Britain's going to leave the single market and the EU, then it's not a choice between more borders or less. It's a choice between which borders you want. And I look at people like my mum, who is a, you know, like me, probably now an Anglo-Scot, moved there at the same time as I did when I was 4 years old, and who's been there for, 26 years now, and who is anti-independence because she has deep roots with England, and, you know, she's a Labour Party member, and she's very passionately pro-European. And for a certain layer of Scottish Labour's base, for a certain layer of perhaps people like that, this choice between that switch of that question, so that it's now about which border do you want, well, do you feel more British or do you feel more pro-European, will peel people away towards independence. On the other hand, what kind of border with England is it going to be? And this, I think, is the big factor for against Scottish independence now. Is that if we leave the customs union and Scotland becomes independent, then there will have to be a hard border on the Scotland-England border. And that is an absolutely huge, huge impediment to Scottish independence and to the popular support for Scottish independence. Because even though in principle it might rise, when the question's actually put, when the practicalities are actually spelled out, a hard border between Scotland and England could make the whole thing unravel.
No, but Michael, you know, you've seen repeatedly that spelling out practicalities almost makes everybody crazier.
It doesn't.
It's not in Scotland and Northern Ireland.
Yeah, in Scotland, Northern
Ireland. In England, it makes everyone crazier. In Scotland and Northern Ireland, those arguments went down very well indeed.
Well, in Scotland and Northern Ireland, it's more than just, here's, you know, in England and in post-industrial places in Scotland and Northern Ireland and Wales as well, you know, the argument of here's the actual facts, please listen to the actual facts, doesn't go down very well because a certain proportion of the electorate is stuck in a mindset where I don't care if it's fully costed, I don't believe the state can do good things, I don't believe any of this is affordable because I've just never had anything good, and therefore I just don't believe this, I don't believe the facts. That's a factor everywhere in the UK. But it's a different kind, it's a much sharper fact if that hard border for a small nation like Scotland or a small region like Northern Ireland is a much sharper kind of fact. Because it would, you know, you're talking about serious hits to living standards potentially if those hard borders go up. So I think you're right. I think the death of the facts and the death of truth is definitely a factor in politics. But with certain kinds of truth and certain kinds of facts, I think it's a really, I think there's potentially a big problem for the independence movement.
But we're all assuming, aren't we, that the SNP can get something away without the Conservative government backing. But presumably, they're in the same fix we are. They're just going to spend the next 4.5 years waiting for a change.
Yeah, I mean, they could go Catalonia and they could... have an unofficial hold.
The thing we haven't factored in here is that there's going to be a big struggle inside the SNP and inside the independence movement. And in particular, I can imagine a lot of the people involved in the Radical Independence campaign, but also involved in other things, and people who are members of the SNP, will absolutely come out and say, we need, you know, if the Tories won't let us have a poll, sorry, we have a right to self-determination, we have an absolute right to have this referendum, especially if they win the next Hollywood elections. And I think at that point, the question will be posed much more sharply. It wouldn't surprise me if by 2021, when those elections are happening, the SNP is going in on a manifesto pledge to hold a referendum come what may. We'll have to see where it goes. And like Luke says, it's not Catalonia. They aren't going to send in riot vans or the army to stop this from taking place. But what you could well see is, for instance, the whole of the Conservative Party, a huge chunk of the electorate, including lots of other unionist voters, just boycotting the whole thing. Which wouldn't necessarily be, you know, I mean, it wouldn't be curtains for the independence movement, but it would just be...
It would deny it the legitimacy.
It probably wouldn't go through with a UDI, a Unilateral Declaration of Independence. So, in the end, Scottish independence is bound up with the success of the anti-Tory bloc in England.